So the first question today, the lucky prize, is, dear Ajahn, last night you mentioned that thoughts don't come into the mind by themselves. I invite them in. I'd appreciate if you could talk a bit more about that. Thank you. Yes, indeed. This is what happens. That you're nice and peaceful and calm and having a wonderful time. This you should be. And then why do you disturb it by getting a thought coming into the mind? It's as if what you do, you open the door and just have a look outside. Any thoughts around? And they come in. And that's the thing. But remember, if a thought does come in to the mind, just be kind to it. Open the door of your heart so the thoughts can go out. Because doors are for coming in and for going out as well. Remember that. So that when a thought comes in, it's because you do actually invite them in. If you were really happy, really content, just the thoughts just say cannot come in at all. In the same way, there's a few Sri Lankans here. When you're watching the cricket, can any thought about lunch, has any thought about the money or your wife or anything else, anything else come in your mind when you're watching your cricket? Absolutely nothing at all. Because you're really involved in it. And some Sri Lankan wives have said, sometimes you're watching the cricket there and you say, darling, the dinner's ready. You don't even hear it. It doesn't even get into the air, but somewhere in the brain it gets cut off. And that's actually, imagine if you could do that when you're sitting meditation. Just so involved in the meditation. Sounds, heat, cold, whatever, nothing actually comes in because you're really absorbed into it. Now there's many examples. If you don't like cricket, music, your movie, your favourite soap opera, whatever it is, there's always times in your life you get so absorbed into something. You're really dying to go to the toilet, but you just can't because you're just really watching to see what's going to happen next. You don't even feel it down there. Now that sort of absorption and one-pointedness, why is it absorbed and why is it one-pointed? It's because you're enjoying, you're fascinated, it engrosses you. Now when that happens, thoughts, they just cannot go into the mind. Nothing goes into the mind. Because you're happy with what you've got. It's that happiness, that joy, that piti sukha, that is the key to the silence of the mind. So when it's really quiet, shh, don't disturb it. And the only reason why you do disturb it, you create the thoughts, you generate it, you start wobbling the mind. Hey, lake, once it gets very calm and still, it stays still. And then a ripple comes. Where did that ripple come from? Because you put your finger in, just to see how still it was. And then when a ripple comes, what do? You try and pat the ripple down. You make more waves. And that's what happens. And one little thought comes up, a little ripple in the mind. You created that. And then you start thinking about the thought. I shouldn't be thinking. I shouldn't be thinking that I shouldn't be thinking. And what am I thinking about anyway? And then it's all the thought, just the whole avalanche comes. But if you're quiet, absolutely still, and even though the whole heap of snow might be waiting to come down, when you're quiet, nothing moves. No snow falls. It needs a trigger, and you are that trigger. That is true. And I used to think that, sometimes to be sitting quietly, not in the deep meditation, but at that stage when thoughts can still come in, and the thought would come in, and instead of just trying to overcome it and get rid of it, part of what we do in meditation is investigate, find out, you know, what's going on, why do these thoughts keep on coming into the mind? Now that's a general thing what we do in meditation. We don't just push through things, we try and understand the mind, understand how it works. So when this comes in, I started thinking, why is it coming in? Where did that come from? And I kept on noticing, it always came in, I was peaceful, but then I started getting either bored with the peacefulness, back of contentment, I wanted something more. I wasn't content. If I was really content, thoughts would not come in. The contentment started to fade away, and then it opened the door for thoughts to come in. And I actually literally went outside the door picking thoughts, something interesting to think about. I had this whole range of thoughts, DVDs or sort of CDs in your stack. You just go picking out which one you're going to pick out. And that's what it really is. So you actually go out collecting those thoughts and bringing them into your mind to disturb yourself. And when you see what you're doing, you realize if you actually are the person who allows those thoughts in and goes to pick them in, then you can actually stop doing that. It's not the fact that it just comes in from somewhere else and you're just a victim. No, you are the one responsible. So if you're the one responsible, you can stop those thinking. And the way you do it is just have more contentment, build up the contentment. With such little mantras as we often teach in the meditation retreat, this is good enough, this is good enough, this is good enough. Doesn't matter how deep you've gone so far. If you've just gone to the stage of just almost, but not quite, overcoming sloth and torpor, you made progress, well done. So this is good enough for me. Now just almost overcome sloth and torpor. That's good enough for this whole meditation retreat. And if you say it's good enough, if you develop contentment, when there's no more craving or desire left, then this stillness, then this peace, and because of contentment and stillness and peace, you don't need these distractions, so the thoughts just don't come. As I said the other day, it's very easy to be still. Isn't that nice? Did a thought come in your mind? If it did, you invited it in because you weren't at ease with that stillness. That's why that in these different stages of meditation, it's a great little exercise that, because when I talk and I pause between the words, people are actually still. And the reason is because you have to wait. You don't know when I'm going to start speaking next. And so because you don't know when I'm going to start speaking next, you're waiting. You can't actually think yourself because out of respect you're waiting for me to start speaking. And that means you are. There it is again, still. It's not that hard. Now, you've got to recognize what that is. And the next thing, be familiar enough with it, you're at ease with it. When you relax in it, then again you don't want to disturb it. Contentment is also being relaxed. Being relaxed with the silence. Oh, this is feel nice, you don't want to disturb it, you don't have to hold it, you don't have to get rid of it. You don't have to do anything with it, it's just there, so you let it be. And then it stays, and there's no thoughts coming into the mind. Now, that's something you can do throughout this whole retreat. Even no matter how tired, restless, no matter what's going on in your meditation, you can always listen to those moments of silence between your thoughts. And there's always plenty there. So notice the silence between your thoughts. Sometimes you're eating and nothing's going on. Notice the silence. When you start to notice the silence, you get familiar with it. And you understand it. And you get at ease with it. And it's only when you get at ease with it, silence stays a long time. You get to know, oh, this is good, this silence. I'm going to stay here as long as possible. You're not afraid of it. You don't want to disturb it. You're at ease, so you relax into the silence. There's one person was saying, it's a very good technique, even when there is sounds outside. See if you can listen to the space between the sounds. So when one bird stops chirping before the next sound begins, see the gaps, the spaces between things. And in that silence, it's a very nice place to hang out. It's a nice place to hang out because nothing is happening, nothing is disturbing you. There's a natural stillness there, and the natural stillness gives you energy and happiness. So that's what you can do. So you don't go inviting in the disturbing thoughts. Leave them outside. Any questions about that? Or rather, any thoughts about that? No thoughts, very good. Next question coming up. Ajahn, Reverend Sir, since there is no self, what is it then that remembers past lives. And what is it that is reborn? Okay. What remembers is just the stream of consciousness, the five khandhas, the process, which is empty process. Here's my favorite simile. Here's a simile of a mango. Because I like mangoes. So I usually eat them and throw the seed away. But if I had a nice place to plant that seed, I would plant that seed of that very sweet mango. And a few years later, who knows, it might germinate and a sapling might come up. A few years later, it might turn into a beautiful mango tree. And who knows, a couple of years later, it might have some fruit. And there I'm eating the second mango. What went across from one mango to the next? Is it the same or is it different? The second mango and the first mango. You know that something goes across because they're both mangoes. It hasn't become an apple. But you can see from stage to stage that first mango seed. You can see every stage is a development, a development, a development. There's a whole process. And at the end of that process, you've got the second mango, and it hasn't got probably, the DNA is completely different. The chemicals, the atoms in there, there's probably not one molecule from the original mango, now in the new mango. Completely different. But a connection there. If that last mango, the first mango was very sweet, it's likely the second mango is sweet, but not always as sweet, maybe a bit more, maybe a bit less. If the first mango tree managed to endure, say, drought conditions, the second mango tree will probably be resistant to drought. It's a karma working. Now when you see it with a mango, you see there's nothing gone across. There's no mango soul, no essence of mango, no cosmic mango consciousness, which was there at the beginning, and this goes all across. But you can see like a process of rebirth happens. Re-mangoation. This is what happens. So you can actually see from this how the process from one life to another life happens. At every stage, from now to the next moment, till tomorrow, to next week, to next year, to the moment you die, you can see that the connection, just how you evolve and how your mind evolves. And even the process when this body dies, in the process of evolving into the Manomaya Kai, the mind-made body, the ghost-like body after you die and seeking a new birth, you can see that whole process. There's a connection from every moment to the next moment. Just like in the mango. And then you find yourself in the womb of your next mother. And you come out and you're a little kid. You're growing again. And there's not one molecule in that new being that was there in the old being. But there is a connection there, a karmic connection. In the same way from one mango to the next mango. That's how, it's a good simile of how rebirth happens without any self or soul. Just a stream of consciousness. Like a river, a stream. The stream is never the same water one minute to the next. It looks the same, but every minute the water under the bridge is new water. The old water has flown away. The same way, every minute, your stream of consciousness is different. The old stuff has flown away. You have a new mind state now. New ideas, new thoughts, new experiences. Always changing. And even the banks which hold a river, even they change over the decades. One bank erodes, the other one silts up, and courses of rivers change. The course of the river, what guides it, is like your karma. Karma changes slowly, but over sort of the decades, your character completely changes. Until sometimes, if they haven't seen you for 20, 30 years, wow, you really changed. But over one day, you could hardly see any change at all. Just like a river, so the stream of consciousness. Never the same, but looks the same. So, there you go. You want to enlighten now? You know there's no self? Ah, come on. Any questions on that? On no self? If you really want to go into details about the physics of the process, that's what dependent origination is all about. Paticca Samuppada, dependent origination, was the Buddha trying to explain how rebirth happens without a soul, the causes and conditions, the process. That's his whole purpose, how reincarnation happens without an essential soul. And that's why when some people come along, and that's actually, this was Buddha Dasa in Thailand, and Jnanawira in Sri Lanka, when they came along and said, no, dependent origination is all about one life. Just, come on, you're missing the point. It was specifically to answer the question of how rebirth happens when there's no essential soul. Now I got the next question. So Ajahn, if someone were to commit suicide, has anyone got any ideas? Please, not here, not on my retreat. Wait till another retreat, please. If someone were to commit suicide, motivated by a wish to end either physical or mental suffering, but then at the last minute, the moment, they manage stillness, would they not have another rebirth? Okay, they wish to commit suicide by a wish to end either physical or mental suffering, in the last mind moment, they manage stillness, would they not have another rebirth? Now that's if those of you who know the story of people like Channa in the time of the Buddha, he committed suicide. There's a couple of monks who committed suicide. Wakali, is it Wakali? Channa was one of them anyway. But anyway, Channa, he was very sick. He actually thought he was enlightened, so he cut his throat. And then, it hurt. And he got afraid, so he realized he wasn't enlightened. It's a bit late. But fortunately, he got his act together in the last moment. And when the people came along and told him, the Buddha actually said, no, actually the last moment he actually got his act together, got still, became fully enlightened, so he didn't get reborn. It was really pushing his luck, but he managed it. So in this, in the last mind mode, they managed stillness, would they not have another rebirth? Channa is one of the examples here. But that's actually very tough to do. I know that, actually Dennis Shepherd, someone was talking about him the other day, a past president of the Buddhist Society, many people who know him, he told me, because he used to work for Samaritans, he was the president of the local chapter of Samaritans, and these were dealing with people who were suicidal. And they'd ring up this number and at the middle of the night, and people like Dennis would, one day a month or one day a week, I forget now, would man the phones all night to take the calls from people who were suicidal. And he came along with some amazing stories. I know one of the stories he came along with, and this is a great story, we should tell this more often. During the Gulf War, I think it was the first Gulf War, he was on duty, and he got a call from this guy who happened to be in Perth, and he announced that he was the inventor, the main inventor of the cluster bomb. He was, I don't know, visiting Perth or living in Perth. And he was seeing in the news the results of his invention. And he was absolutely suicidal. You can imagine what it would feel like. You know, you're like a little boy playing with toys and playing with explosion, making things go bang. And, you know, make this cluster bomb. And now actually you see what it does. And the karmic result of that was huge. The pain, the suffering in his mind. And I don't know if Dennis, who took the call, managed to convince him not to commit suicide. But that would be a tough one to do. Imagine that was you. You know, when you're actually inventing things in a lab, you know, you don't see the consequences of your actions. It's just a bomb, it goes bang. But when you see it being used and killing little kids, women, children, and men, everybody, wow, that's heavy karma. And Dennis told me, so you can see the karma when you play around with things like that. That guy was suffering immensely. But he also said there was a piece of research done. In the United States, in San Francisco, many people, when they commit suicide, they go to the Golden Gate Bridge and jump off, because you actually walk across the bridge, and it's like a tourist thing to do, and, you know, it's not that hard to climb up and jump off, and it's a huge way down. But some people survive the fall. You know, because, you know, it's water, and if you sort of land properly, you know, you may sort of break your leg or something, but you don't die. And they did a survey of the people who actually, I think about 30 people or something, in the last 10 years, had actually survived. They went over there to commit to a jump off. And they said 2/3 of them, halfway down, changed their mind. a great statistic. Okay, it's a bit late. But most of the time, that was actually the people who survived, and they thought it's probably the same the people who actually did commit suicide. You know, when you sort of get very depressed and then you decide to do it and you're falling, and then you think, my God, what have I done? So fortunately, from those two-thirds who survived, they managed to tell the tale. So be careful of suicide. You know, sometimes after you do it, you say, what have I done? Big mistake. Big mistake. But if you wish to end physical or mental suffering, and you might last a moment, you manage stillness, it's a tough one to do. But it can be done. And you know the other story, I usually tell this on the last day of the retreat. And that's the story of the bhikkhuni. Do you remember what her name was? Was it not Wajira? And I've got it somewhere. Anyway, it was a bhikkhuni. And she'd been meditating, she'd been a bhikkhuni for 7 long years. And she hadn't got one moment of peace in her meditation, not once. Now that makes you feel a bit better. Because this was a bhikkhuni at the time of the Buddha, you know, the great teachers around. And not 9 days, 7 years, full on. And never once did she get any peace in her mind. So you know what she did after 7 years? She thought, no way am I going to go back to, you know, washing dishes in the house. No way am I going to go back to a husband. So she only had one choice. If I can't stay as a bhikkhuni because I've got no peace, and I don't want to go back into living in a house with a husband and cooking and cleaning. Only one thing to do. So she got a length of rope. She went into the forest, climbed a tree. She tied one end to the branch of a tree, the other one around her neck, and she's just about to jump off, and then she had her first moment of stillness. And she didn't actually say what she got, whether it was like a jhana or whether it was a stage of enlightenment, but it was enough for her to sort of take off the rope. She found her stillness in the end, so she never committed suicide. Came very close, and that's in her story in the in the Therigatha. Because some great stories to read. So, I know that sometimes, you know, we have this idea that, you know, all in the time of the Buddha, these monks and the nuns were supermen and superwomen. But it's great to read their stories. And even though it's 2,500 years ago in the culture of India, it actually is quite alive. And you read these and you can actually relate to many of these stories. And these are stories, you know, historical accounts of people who were meditating and trying to become enlightened and how they did it and, you know, the difficulties they went through. They're great stories to read. So I really recommend those. It's not just the teachings or what you should do. This is personalized accounts of the struggle for enlightenment. Men and women. With the equity there. So there's some of those stories about people who, in the last moment, they managed to actually to do it. And the thing is that they only actually say about the people who actually made it at the end. Those people, those nuns and monks probably, who actually, you know, jumped off the tree and didn't get enlightened at the last minute, they never actually made it into the storybook. They were just deleted out. So it's, be careful, it's not a very good thing to do, but it is possible. The last moment of stillness, you can sort of stop rebirth. Because when you're dying is not an event, it's a process. I don't know if there are any doctors here, but I mean, that's why doctors have told me, because when you've been with a person who's dying, and it's very hard to say actually the point. You're still watching them now. You can see when they stop breathing, but they're not dead yet. You see just when actually they die. They die. And I remember asking a doctor, when did they actually die? What moment? What second? They said, look, you can't say that, because dying is a process. You know, in maybe 2 or 3 minutes, the beginning of that process, they're alive. The end of that process, they're dead. But to say the actual moment between those 3 minutes when death occurred, impossible. It's a whole process. Let's stop it. Not an event. And that's why I like that idea, because life is a process, not an event. Death is a process, it's not an event. So during that event, you know, when it's irreversible, you do have a little bit of time to actually to reflect on the Dhamma, to especially to make the mind still and peaceful. And know the best thing to do when you're dying? Stop controlling! Let go! Make peace! Stop trying to do something when you're dying. Exactly what I've been teaching you here. If you get the message of this retreat, then you're going to die beautifully. So this is how to die teachings of this retreat. So when you go back home, what did you learn in this retreat? I learned how to die. That's weird. That's what happened. Somebody actually, remember Chittapala, he got this wonderful story from the Time magazine. Now, people were talking about some of the weird things about what the mind does. A year or two ago, this was actually in January 2007, a special edition of Time magazine about the nature of the mind. This article was written by a doctor in the United States who had a patient who had a brain tumour, completely untreatable. And the brain tumour, I always thought when brain tumours grow and grow and grow in the brain, they'd actually squash and compress the good part of the brain, destroying it. But apparently that's not what happens. The tumour actually colonises the brain. So it actually takes it over. So the tumour grows and just takes over part of the brain, and part of the brain becomes tumour. And so the viable part of the brain gets less and less and less as the tumour grows. So it's as if, you know, that the brain was becoming eaten away by the tumour, like that mad cow disease. The amount of brain gets less and less and less day by day. And the doctor knew exactly what would happen. You know, that the person would gradually lose control of all of their functions. You know, they'd lose control of their mental functions, it would stop remembering, stop being able to speak, and stop being able to control their bodily functions. Little by little, they get closer and closer to being like that carrot, that vegetable. But this was actually the true story. And the doctor just knew that that was going to happen and just really hated going in to see that patient because there was no hope. And of course it soon got to the point where it was basically comatose because, you know, there's hardly any brain function left, just enough to keep the bodily functions going. And it was only a few days before death happened. And when after death did happen, he was surprised at the reaction of the family members who were there at the time. Something strange had happened, and he asked the family members what had happened. And they told him his brain was almost gone, probably totally gone, when he opened his eyes. And he bent up in bed and started talking to his relations. And so for 15 minutes, fully conscious, fully talking, being able to hear and everything. And then after that 15 minutes, he fell back and died. Completely impossible, according to medical science, without a brain. You could be conscious, talk, be intelligent, and have a conversation, and tell how much, you know, you love your family and friends. That's what he did. A wonderful little example of the last moments. Even if you've got no brain left, the mind takes over, and you become alert, awake, fully conscious. A couple of people here that told me, I don't know if they're here because I can't forget who they were. One of the ladies who comes to Nolamara, she said that her father was dying and they were in the last moment. You never know when it's going to happen. You sit there and sit there and sit there and sit there, you know, all morning, come on, get over and done with that. We know it's going to happen. Sitting there and sitting there, and they were just both holding one side of the bed each, holding their father's hand. And then suddenly the father opened his eyes. Again, bent up, looked around, and they said, quite simultaneously, without plan, they said, we love you, Dad. And then he fell down and died. It's very common. The last moments are really weird. As if the brain and the body just fall apart, and your mind becomes free of the brain and body, and becomes alert, awake. And that's the moment. No matter how much suffering, how much morphine you've had, the last moment's always clear. And that's the moment when you can remember what your Dhamma is, remember what you should be doing, and really start to do some proper practice of letting go, making peace. Because if you're still at the last moments, then you don't get reborn. If you're agitated, you will create the next birth. Make sense? Okay, that's where actually dependent origination, sankhara paccaya vijnana. The rebirthing in consciousness is made by the sankharas, the moving of the mind. Atajan, thanks for the air conditioner in meditation room. This is very helpful. There's no windows for cool air. Ha 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 ha. Yeah, sometimes there's air conditioning, sometimes there isn't. But the cool air never comes from the windows. The cool air comes from within your mind. When you're cool, so you don't think and complain about anything. Because if you're complaining, even if there was an air conditioner, it's too cold, or it's too hot, or it's not cold enough. So it's never perfect. I know that in my Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center, when I was planning it, what I thought of doing would be about 60 people, 60 rooms there. And so we have 60 seats in the room, and have like personal air conditioners coming down. So you can all got your own controls. But then you would still complain, I'm sure. Because it gets the head, doesn't get underneath, one from the side as well. Now the point is, there's no way you can make a perfect retreat centre, no way you can have perfect air conditioning. So that way, I just leave it alone, it's good enough. So stop worrying about it. The more you think about it, the hotter you get. So just, those people who are cold, just go and think about a lot. Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahm, was it difficult becoming a monk? Ah, no, it's really easy being a monk. It's much easier being a monk than getting married. That's really tough. I don't know how you guys do it. Did the monk ever wander back to your mother and father, siblings and girlfriends? Did you ever wish that you hadn't become a monk? And how did you overcome all this? Do these feelings still surface today? Or was it only while you were a young monk? Do I still pine for my old girlfriend? Do I sometimes wonder, where is she now? Is she still thinking of me? It's crazy, of course I don't. She's probably old and dead now. All of them. No, I did wander back. I was actually, no, that's the old joke, you know, that somebody asked me once, you know, did you become a monk because of a broken heart? Was that the reason why you left the world? To disappear into the jungles of Thailand to forget? I said, no. And this woman said, see, you've forgotten, I was right. It was logical, I suppose. But no, it wasn't difficult becoming a monk, because you know, I was somebody who was almost like born to be a monk. And I look back upon how I lived before, I was never interested in money. And even like little things, I remember wearing flip-flops, the thongs, in the snow when I was, you know, in London and Cambridge. You know, I was weird. So I never really fat into the world. I really fat into being a monk. As soon as I became a monk, after 3 days of being a novice monk, I realised that that's always what I wanted to do in life. And from that time, I've never looked back. I never wanted to describe or do anything else, ever. And even after about 2 years, one of the best friends who was sitting next to me, he disrobed. And I went back to my hut and said, do I want to disrobe? Why don't I disrobe? And I just couldn't find any reason whatsoever. I was just happy being a monk. So I'm very happy, very special there, that I've never actually ever wanted to do anything else than be a monk. So it's a nice lifestyle. I recommend it. And I remember just even in the first month, sometimes you'd be asleep, you'd have nightmares. You know what my nightmare was? That I wasn't a monk, I was a layperson. That was a nightmare, and I'd wake up in a sweat, and I'd open my eyes, and I'd see my robes next to me. Oh, I'm still a monk. And I'd go happy back to sleep again. That's true. Happened about, you know, 4 or 5 times that first month. You know, I sort of, you know, the thinking was still from lay life, and I thought I was a monk, a lay person. And I opened my eyes, I was a monk. Oh, thank goodness. So it was nightmares. I was afraid. Oh my goodness, what's going on? So yeah, no. That's a very happy monk. So that's very easy for me to become a monk. Other people, it's very difficult being a monk. You know, sometimes they take a lot of sensuality, or you know, they've not got such good meditation, they have a hard time being a monk or a nun. So those are the ones, you know, I'm more respectful of, because they had a much easier time than me. I think, wow, well done, yes, how hard it is for you, but you're still keeping in there, well done. So those are the ones you should respect. Don't look at him, he's a happy monk. So I really respect those people who struggle. So I had an easy time with it. Any comments or questions about that? Okay. Next question. In this morning's talk, you mentioned about the mind being made up of the doer and the knower. And in meditation, one should be a knower. In that case, that when we try to make the breath more interesting, how do we avoid being a doer? Very good. If you try and make the breath more interesting as a doer, it does tend to disturb things. However, as I did mention, in the earlier part of the meditation, because the mind isn't so subtle yet, it's still quite gross and coarse, a little bit of doing doesn't affect it that much. The deeper you go in meditation, the more that any type of doing will actually disturb the meditation. So at the very beginning, a little bit of doing, yeah, it's a disturbing, but it's not that problem, not much of a problem. So you can do a little bit of this and that at the beginning of the meditation, but don't do too much. A little nudge here, a little suggestion there, fine. But don't go further than that. But one of the best ways of making the breath more interesting, again, is actually doing nothing. Sometimes just to keep you simple enough to allow the process to happen. Because when you do nothing, energy flows into knowing rather than into doing. Got a certain amount of energy, it can go into one or two ways. It goes into the doing or it goes into the knowing. If it goes into the doing, you get sort of restless, and also the knowing doesn't get any energy, which means you get dull. Mindfulness isn't strong, which is also why many people do a lot, get very depressed and tired, and they're sort of not all that alert. But if you stop doing things, and the energy which would have been wasted in thinking, doing, planning, complaining, whatever, all that energy is free to go into knowing. So the knowing gets the best share of the energy. You get awake, alert, and happy. So every time you do something, you're actually wasting energy. Especially when it's not that important, not that necessary to do anything. It's a waste of mental energy. That's why when you stop the thinking business, that wastes a huge amount of energy. Actually, somebody, a doctor once told me, I think, most of the food, the energy from the food, actually gets used in the brain. That brain takes up more energy than the legs, the arms, and everything else. It's amazing how much energy your brain consumes. So these times of global warming where we've got to sort of lessen our energy consumption, I think we should stop thinking so much. And certainly you have more energy going into knowing. You'll be more alert, more awake, and more perceptive because the mindfulness grows. So really, just when you are just beginning the meditation and you're just watching the breath, try to make it more interesting. It's just like a little crutch for the time being. So it's interesting enough, you don't have to do anything, and then when you're not doing anything, it becomes more interesting naturally. You don't have to do anything. The process has begun. Stillness leading to happiness, leading to more stillness, leading to more happiness. So that's actually how meditation works. Once you get to that happy meditation, then you don't have to put forth effort, therefore you're still, therefore energy, more energy flows into knowing. And you wake up, you get more alert, you get more perceptive, you can see more of the breath, see more of the mind. It becomes more detailed what you're seeing and experiencing of life. You are waking up. You know what the meaning of the Buddha is? Buddha comes from the word Bhujati, the awakened one. Which means to wake up. That's why you need this powerful stillness to create the amount of mindfulness that you literally wake up to the reality rather than being in sleep. That's why when you get more powerful mindfulness, you're getting closer and closer to being a Buddha. And a happy Buddha too. Any questions about that? Okay, here we go, the next question. When I'm observing my breath, I make a commentary in my head of the observation. Smooth, a bit rattly at the start, deep, whatever. I'm sure that actually the rattling is, that's when you die, isn't it? Be careful. Rattle, then gone. I'm assuming that the commentator is the doer. Yes. A little further on in the meditation, the commentary slows down. And what I'm left with is simply the sensation of breathing in and breathing out. The attention to detail has gone. Am I doing it right? Now I think what you might mean there is like some detail has disappeared. So you're actually getting more sensitive to like the small things. Because this is a simile from the Visuddhimagga, the simile of the carpenter sawing a piece of wood. When the carpenter starts sawing a piece of wood, here we go, Let's get a piece of wood. This is the wood, this is my saw. So, we're sawing the wood backwards and forwards. Visual, eh? And when you start sawing the piece of wood, you can see the end of the saw, you can see the handle, you can see the whole length of wood. But as you focus in, and after a while you can just see the few saw teeth where they meet that part of the wood being cut. Because the rest is not relevant at all. You focus in. You see just that point where the saw is touching the wood. And the other details disappear. That's a simile from the Visuddhi Magga. And it's a great simile because what this means is you don't know whether it's the beginning of an in-breath or the end of the in-breath. Because all the saw teeth look the same. All you see is one saw tooth. All you see is one moment of breath. You don't know whether it's at the beginning or the end or the middle of the breath. You don't even know whether it's the in-breath or the out-breath. Because you're focused much closer to the point of touch. So all those ideas of in or out have disappeared. You're just aware of breath. Just saw tooth touching a tiny piece of wood. Now that's a great simile because as you focus in, the external detail disappears. And actually what you're focusing on is a fine point of reality. But you see that very, very clearly. So it's this, the simile of the my hillside going up to Serpentine. Now first of all you see the whole hillside. But then when you still, you just focus on maybe one rock and one piece of lichen on the rock. And that's just so amazing. That just takes your whole attention. You investigate these fine points. The other detail of the hillside has disappeared, but what you're focusing on, there's enough detail in there to fill a whole hillside. So that may be, I think, hopefully that's what's happening. As you're meditating, meditation is going deeper, the external details are disappearing, but the fine point of the breath, that is opening out and filling the mind with all its details. In-breath or out-breath have disappeared. You just know breath. Body. Where's the body gone? Time has disappeared. All those unnecessary details have vanished. And you've got a very refined focus. It's part of the process of meditation called focusing, which I'll talk about in another talk. So hopefully that's what you're doing. If that's happening, well done. It's going well. So you see more detail, but of a smaller area of reality. That's what's supposed to be happening. The one pointedness, the focusing of the mind. Any comments, questions about that? Next question, coming up. Dear Ajahn, if the mind was joyful and stayed effortlessly on the breath during day one and day two, and today some concentration was lost and the mind kept wandering, is this a sign of regress, or is it something that could be expected? Oh, you're getting worse and worse and worse and worse. The days go by, if that's happening one day, day one and day two, your mind was joyful and stayed effortlessly on the breath during day one and day two. But today some concentration was lost and the mind kept wandering. But by day nine, you'll be absolutely crazy. You'll be a basket case. No, that doesn't happen. Not usually, but some people, the first couple of days, they've got a lot of inspiration because they've been psyching themselves up for the retreat, they've got lots of energy, here we go for it. And so you've got like inspiration energy. But after two or three days, here we go again. Same old chanting, same old jokes, same old cushion, and same old room. And sometimes, you know, you lose the inspiration. It's just like after the 2 days of honeymoon period, once you're married, the third day, what have I done this for? Maybe it lasts longer than that, I don't know. Never been married. But you understand what I'm talking about. That doesn't matter. Someday concentration was lost. Sometimes it's also the case, not just the honeymoon period going, the first few days of retreat. Sometimes it's also, you know, one gets a bit sort of taking for granted just the joy and happiness. It worked the first day, the second day, so one expects it to be the same or even better the third day. And we always remember, expectation. That's a big danger in meditation. So we don't have expectation, we have the opposite. What's the opposite of expectation? Inspectation. In other words, we inspect. We go look inside something. Expect is look outside of something. So expectation. Same as the opposite of inspiration. is desperation. So don't get desperate. Just watch don't respirate, don't get desperate. Just keep on breathing, watch your breath. And so when we are first couple of days, if things go well one day, we expect the next day to be even better. And this expectation is probably the reason why you lost your concentration today. So just make peace with everything. And stop worrying about the time, it's day one, day two, day three. In fact, if you don't want to know the date today, it's the nowth day of the nowth month, 2000 and now. Who cares what day it is? It's only when you have to write a letter or do something, you have to worry about the time. But here, forget about the time. Who knows whether it's a Monday or Tuesday or Thursday, who cares? It's all the same, isn't it? You don't have to go to work, so who cares whether it's a Monday or a Sunday? So we're free of time. You know, when I was in Thailand, every day was the same. And after a few years, I actually forgot what year it was. Because I remember somebody coming into the monastery and I had to, for some reason, have to know the year. So what year is it, please, today? I know that from people who look after mental health, if they think you're a bit crazy, if you had a fall or something, or, you know, they call the ambulance, that's the first thing they ask you. What day is it today? I'd be one of the first people to go in the ambulance and go to Greyland. Because they don't know what the day of the month is. Not you're crazy, it's just you forgot time. But most people, that's one of the questions they ask you. You know, what day is it today? And if you get that one wrong, you're on the first ambulance to the funny farm. I'm in trouble that way, so I'd better be careful. So I think that's what happens. You might get wondering, it's a sign of regress. No, it's just, you know, you always make progress. Sometimes you go up a little bit, down a bit, up a bit, down a bit, like a sort of a bit of a seesaw, but it inclines upwards. So usually there's always progress in the long term. Just like stock market. You know, follow the stock market. Stock market crashes and but it always goes up over the 3 or 4 or 5 year cycle. So don't have to worry about these things. So yeah, you're getting progress, it's just you've had a little bit of a blip on the road, it'll come back again. But don't expect anything. Remember what caused peace and happiness, just create the causes, don't worry about the results. Can you please tell us a little bit about metta meditation? What did Buddha say about it and how did it promote mindfulness? Yeah, this is metta meditation. May all beings be happy and well. May I be happy and well. May all the mosquitoes be happy and well. May all the cockroaches in my room be happy and well. That's metta meditation. You get so much loving kindness to cockroaches, they all come to your room and leave my room. So I really recommend that. So please do cockroach meditation tonight. Go on. But what loving kindness meditation is, it's like the door of my heart is open to all beings, no matter what they are, but not just human beings, like mind states, bodies, breath, everything. So that way, you know, you're having like a loving kindness to all things. Otherwise called letting go. It's actually exactly the same type of meditation. The same attitude of mind. Being kind, being gentle, letting go. Which is why, one of my old jokes, sometimes I teach breath meditation. And when people find it difficult doing breath meditation, interviewers say, look, I can't do breath meditation. Can you give me something else to do? So I teach them Anapanasati instead. And when they can't do Anapanasati, then I teach them metta meditation, which means loving kindness. But they don't know that. It's metta meditation. And then when metta meditation doesn't work, I teach them loving kindness meditation. And then they come back to me and they say, well, I've tried Anapanasati, I've tried breath meditation, I've tried metta meditation, and I've tried loving kindness meditation. I do letting go meditation. So I do letting go meditation. It's all exactly the same. It's the attitude of mind. It does not matter what you're watching, it's how you're watching it. So it really doesn't matter whether it's metta meditation or whether it's breath meditation, Anapanasati meditation. As long as you're doing it with peace, with kindness, with letting go. Loving kindness focuses on just letting things go, allowing things to be, by doing it to people. And if you do it to people, then maybe you'll be able to do it to things. This pain in my body, this ache, this tiredness, leave it alone, let it go. The door of my heart's open to it. Then you get still and get peaceful. So really, all meditation is the same. Just, you know, sometimes we teach these different things just to get people interested enough. Give them something to do until it starts to work. It is said that wisdom comes from life experiences. Monastics, monks live away from these life experiences. So how do they become wise? Very good question. Amazing, some of the things which I've got up to as my life as a monk. Many of you know these stories. Going off to the local radio station in East Perth, 96 FM, 6 PR. Late at night, because they wanted me to go and give a talk there. Friday night, I gave a talk at Nolamara, and there was a night thing. I was in town, not doing very much, so after the talk I went to the radio studio. Got there just by 10 PM, because usually the talk at Nolamara is 8 to 9. And thought, and I'd have plenty of time to get to the studio, but people always, they queue up asking questions. Even though at the end of every talk I say, are there any questions? People are silent. And then as soon as the talk is finished, they're all queuing up with their questions. So it's being dishonest, isn't it? You should put your hand up if you've got a question after the talk. But anyhow, so one of those days, people queuing up, so I had to race to the radio station, got there just in time before they were 10 o'clock. So rushed into the studio, and then didn't have time to even say hello, put the headphones on, microphone in front, and then... Now, I was actually 2 or 3 minutes, because they had like, the news or something, some announcements before the show started. And that's when the radio presenter pointed out the co-guest, the co-host to the show, was Dr. Gabriel Morrissey. First time I heard her name, but apparently she is a Australian-wide famous sexologist. She writes books about sex. So what sort of program am I on? He said, it's on adult themes. Oh my goodness. There's no way out. I was in the studio and for 2 hours you had to field questions from the general public on the most intimate of the things. And there I was, 2 hours, sort of asking questions about sex. And I'm a monk. You know, I've been celibate about 34 years. And how did I get myself into this one? But the fascinating thing was, you know, that even though I didn't have those life experiences, at least not for 34 years, that after about 5 minutes, all the questions were coming to me. People from the general public ringing up, you know, they couldn't pronounce Ajahn Brahm, so we decided, you know, to call me Mr. Monk. That's true. I got told off by that by some other people, to be more respectful. So I've got a question for Mr. Monk. And all these questions are coming to me. And the expert, the world-renowned Australian expert who writes books on sex, she was sitting there doing absolutely nothing, getting bored. And I was the expert. Well, why me? Why am I the expert on sex when I haven't had sex for 34 years? Well, it shows you that wisdom does not come from life experiences. Otherwise, no one would be asking me. And the other similar story was... For those of you who know Alana McTiernan, she's the Minister of Planning, but she was the Minister of Transport before. And we got to know her very well. And there was a series that had a lot of trouble, like with transport issues, and she decided after she was elected to have like a transport summit. Invited members of the general public to actually to talk about, you know, how many heavy trucks we should have on our road. And so I was invited to go along. So I went along there, you know, for a day summit at the Duxton Hotel over in Perth. And just during the lunch period, this guy came up to me and he says, no, he's a journalist. And, you know, would you mind if he interviews me? About what? About shipping. I said, okay. I'm game for anything. So I've been on the ship before. But that's about all I know. So I gave him this interview about shipping, and I just asked the questions as best I know how. And of course he went away, I forgot about it. About 6 months later he came back to Nolamara Centre, and he said, Ajahn Brahm, you wouldn't believe how popular that article was. I said, true, I don't believe it. But he said, that article, you know, he called it, it's very sort of, Keith, he called it sort of Zen and the Art of Shipping by Ajahn Brahm. He said that was syndicated to nearly all of the major shipping magazines in the whole world. It was a really popular article. He got all his emails back you know, from all these experts saying we don't know who that Ajahn Brahm is, but he certainly knows what he's talking about. And of course I had a good clue what I was talking about. I just made it up as I went along. So that just shows you don't need to know anything about shipping to be an expert on shipping. So sometimes I wonder, where does wisdom come from? It comes from just the silence of the mind, the calmness, the peace. And once you get sort of the essence, you know, of wisdom, then you can be an expert on sex when you haven't had sex for years. You can be an expert on shipping when you don't really know one end of a ship from another. And it's amazing what you can become an expert on. Simply because you have this deep understanding of the nature of mind and cause and effect. So wisdom doesn't come from life experience. Wisdom comes from silence. And that's one thing which I know about. Any questions about that? Okay, here comes the next question. Dear Ajahn, you are not a lousy teacher. Okay, very good. We return here every year because we simply enjoy your teachings. You must be masochists enjoying the same old jokes every year. Besides, this is a wonderful place, and Bianca is such a great cook. Yeah, I agree on that. You just come here for the food, that's what you come here for. Oh, I'm hurt now. Value for money, too. Maybe we should put the price up. Actually, the price is going down. But we have our retreat centre. The retreat centre is absolutely for free. Just by donations only. That's a wonderful thing, is that we can give these teachings and there's no money involved. Although I must admit that one of the things we probably will do, you know, for this Jhana Grove Retreat Centre, will be like a $50 registration fee, which you get back when you turn up. Because otherwise, you know, if it's ever for free, people just say, yeah, I'll do that, and haven't got any sort of intention of going to the retreat, just like a maybe, and they'll take the places from other people. So this is a suggestion, it's not sort of in concrete yet, but maybe when we start the retreat centre, that if anyone wants to register, $50 registration fee, or $20, I don't know how much, but they get it back when they turn up. So it's all for free. And they put a donation afterwards if they want to, in the donation box for maintenance. But you know, it's given for free because, you know, meditation, it's liberating for you. You can't put a price on it, so it really should be given for no outlay. Besides, it's a wonderful place. Bianca's a great cook. Ready for money, too. There's still so much more to learn from a great teacher like you. Ever so humorous, your similes are also very powerful tools for learning. We are indeed blessed to be your students. Thanks for sharing your experiences after this 9-day retreat. We shall continue to practice our meditation back home and return again next year for another retreat. Oh, can I retire? Look, 65, you're supposed to be able to retire. When will you let me retire? 70, 80, 90? That's the trouble with monks, it's a bad profession. So we've got no retirement. You say, how do we do retire? But when we do retire, we retire properly, out of samsara forever. Anyway, thank you for that sort of praise. You see how hard it is to accept praise? I should have said, oh, thank you so much, that you're quite right. Whoever said that, yes, I'm not allowed to teach, I'm a great teacher, and I'm humorous. It's hard to say that, isn't it? Because of our conditioning. Dear Ajahn, if Mara is equivalent to the tempter, the evil one, could you please explain the higher realm where beings control others? How is it that this is a higher realm? Is it below the Brahma realm, above the devas, and yet Mara abides here? Could you explain? Yes, a great question. That sort of really made me sort of, I wonder, why do you get like a Mara in such a place as this? This is a high heaven realm. You get this evil guy, this bad fellow, this nasty character who is like a heavenly being. And the answer is that, what is the answer? That Lord Acton, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So that even, you know, someone like George Bush, he must have had enormous, powerful, good karma to have actually got into like the position of being a president. You know, you can't have sort of no good karma to get into that position. But when you get into that position, sometimes the position can corrupt you. And many presidents and prime ministers, they start off and they've got really good intentions and they really do try and do the best. They stay there too long And sometimes they do get very, very corrupted by the position. So Mara had enormous good karma, got reborn in this realm where you enjoy power, the different levels of sometimes happiness. And what do sort of people start off in this world, and they want to sort of be rich, because rich gives you a bit of power. But what do rich people do, like Malcolm Turnbull? Then they start to become politicians. Once they got the big house and the girls or big yachts or whatever, many rich people, they wanted just to go one higher level of happiness and have power over others. So it's actually power is a drug, is a sort of a source of happiness, but it's one of the most dangerous forms of happiness. The satisfaction of being in control of others. It gives you the huge ego. When you control, you have huge egos. So Mara's got the biggest ego, even bigger than George Bush. If George Bush keeps going the way he's going, maybe he'll be the next Mara. So Mara starts off as a good guy, but the position he's in, controlling others, creates this stupidity. And that stupidity turns into being like quite evil of others. That's why control is a very, very dangerous thing. Be very careful. If you're in any position of authority and power, be very, very careful. Because the more you try and control others, just the more that you get corrupted by that control. You can even see that in your meditation. The more you try and control the mind, the more you corrupt the mind. So there always have to be checks and balances. Otherwise, my monks are my checks in the monastery to make sure that I don't overdo the control business in the monastery. In a Buddhist society, I'm the spiritual director, sometimes we say the spiritual dictator of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. But I'm not that. You've got Sisawam to keep me in check, and also the members of the Buddhist Society, they'll keep me in check. Because there's only a certain amount of things I can do. So that's important, never to actually to be in a position of absolute control, because it will corrupt you. Yeah. Oh yeah, it is in Yeah, it's made you to control seek. But this is like the karma can take you to that state. But he hasn't got the ability to get into the jhana realms. He's not just on the edge of jhanas. He's just used all his good karma to actually to get the controller very, very strong, instead of using his good karma to let go. So he's had almost enough good karma to actually to get the jhanas, but he hasn't employed it in that direction. He's made use of it to control and exert power. You have a question? The Mara in the mind is the control freak in the mind, which tempts you. You just put a little bit more effort in, you get into jhanas. Come on, just watch the breath and hold the breath. It'll work. Come on. You can do that. Come on, who are you down here anyway? You can do this. You know, that you're a smart girl. You know, you've had so many achievements so far. This is easy. Come on, you can do it. And that sort of tempt is saying that you can do it. And you take control. And you take charge. That's like the tempter. Instead of just, don't let go, leave it alone. Say, if I let go, it won't work. That's Mara again. If I just let go, I'll just be sleeping more and just doing less and be thinking all over the place. That's Mara speaking. That's a Mara inside. Is that what you meant? You think it's you, yes. So you are the one in control. But you ain't. Anyway, let's get going to the next question. Reflecting on the opera story, it means that most people have no hope of going beyond the reach of Mara, i.e. the jhanas, due to their karma, a strong will to be. Is there some strategy, a fast-track purification practice to erode the ego so that it's sufficiently stymied to allow me to access samadhi? Yes, there is. Become a monk or a nun. That's a fast track. Any volunteers? Who did that question anyway? I'll do the analysis of your writing and compare that compare that to the sheet which you filled in to come here. I go get that from Bianca. Yeah, it is actually, because when you become especially a young monk or a young nun, you know, you've got hardly any control at all. You can't even control what you eat. So it's great being a monk, because especially a young monk, you're just a nobody. Maybe this famous person, rich, but now you're end of the line, and there's no one talks to you. That's why, you know, when I first came here, the way I was trained in Thailand was that, you know, the senior monk does all the talking, and you're the attendant. You just sit there, just like Venerable Santuti. He has nobody's mouth, except, you know, in the monk's quarters. But he's supposed to do that. I'm not criticizing him. But I was doing this for the first year when there was another monk, Ajahn Jaki, you might remember. And I was always the attendant. There's only two of us here. So he'd give the talks, and he'd ask the question. I'd be sitting there. And then after about 6 months or 7 months when I was here, you know, he went to Thailand, you know, for a little bit of a holiday, a bit of a break, and to visit Ajahn Chah. And so I gave the talk one night. And it was a girl, 14-year-old, 15-year-old girl. It was Kelly, you know, Suni's daughter. And she had her mouth open. I was talking. And she came up afterwards and said, "That was amazing, you can talk. I thought you were mentally deficient." He used to sit there and say nothing, like a dummy. That's true. I mean, I wasn't mentally deficient, I was just being restrained. So that's actually what happens. But because of the training you have, like being a monk or a nun, sometimes that is a huge benefit. If Oprah ordained as a nun at Dharmasala Monastery, would you have her? Don't be frightened, it won't happen. It's just a maybe. Then I think that, you know, she would go beyond the reach of mouth. You wouldn't be able to control anything. Take away a mobile phone. Now, who would she be able to interview? Maybe Sister Wayana? I don't know. So that sort of restricts the sort of the sense of doing. So it does erode the ego when you become a monk or a nun. Other than that, most other people have the chance, and sometimes just the happiness of meditation. You really get into it. And sooner or later, it gets very clear. The more you control, the more you mess things up, the more you expect deep meditation, the more your mind doesn't get anywhere. And sooner or later, you get the message that you just let go, relax, don't do anything, and everything comes to you. And when that message gets through your experience, you know, that you are encouraged to carry on further in this beautiful way of letting go, leaving things be, of kindness and gentleness. And that just destroys your addiction to controlling. You know, the ego is just a pain in the butt, so you just let it go. And the happiness, the joy which you experience yourself is one of the greatest motivations for becoming enlightened. It's just suffering not to be, and it's fun to be peaceful. And that's a great motivation. So you just get a little bit of happiness and joy, and that motivates you to come back to the next retreat. Which is why many people do keep coming back, seriously, because they come here and something happens. They get peace, they get some happiness, they get some really powerful meaning. And they come back to explore it some more and make it deeper. So I say that was one of the reasons I became a monk. Probably the best, the biggest reason why I became a monk is just deep meditation experiences. I already mentioned about, you know, the bliss better than sex. One of those experiences I had, my first meditation retreat as a 19-year-old in Cambridge. And that just really blew me away. How can you have so much happiness, so much joy, long-lasting, you know, just by sitting still? And that's, well, I really want to find out more about that. So that's why, you know, the first opportunity when I was retired to become a monk. Really explore the depth and the power and the joy of the mind. So you get a little bit of happiness, and that really sort of hooks you into finding out why. Ajahn, I think there should be a lunch bell. Many got late for it. No air conditioning early morning, please. Thank you. Okay, a lunch bell and no air conditioning. Maybe what we can do is actually turn on the air conditioning just before lunch. So that will wake you up and show it's time to go to lunch. I don't know, anyway. But remember, you can't always get what you want. So sometimes there's a lunch bell, sometimes there ain't. Usually because I have to go off and be teaching the interviews at lunch. So if you want a lunch bell, there's a bell here, ring it. We have a rule in many monasteries, such as mine, anyone who comes up with an idea about what to do in my monastery, if it's a good idea, say, right, you do it. So anyone with an idea, they have to follow it through and make it work. You don't get many people volunteering ideas then. So I think it's a great idea. Whoever wants to do that, you have the job of ringing the lunch bell every lunch at 11 o'clock. Okay, fair enough. And air conditioning, again, some people like air conditioning, some people don't. So I reckon that side is on. I see the green light. So that air conditioner is on and that one is off. Shall we have it that way? So people who like air conditioning, go on that side of the room. People who don't like air conditioning, go on that side of the room. Keep everybody happy. And those, the wise people who like the middle way, can go in the middle. So you can't please everybody. Question. Ruka Mula is also translated as the base of a tree. Would that not be better than the root of a tree? Yeah, it's better that the root of a tree is actually base of a tree, Ruka Mula. But even the base of a tree, if you ever go to a Bodhi tree, it's a fig tree. And the fig's actually the base. The roots are actually above the ground, you know, at the base of a tree. And there's just so many of them, they're all over the place. So that's why if you ever go and see an established Bodhi tree, well, even over here, like a Moreton Bay fig in the parks over there, it's the same type of tree. You can see that, or banyan, it's just roots all over the place. So you've got to go a long way from the base of the tree before it gets level ground. That's why it'd be very, very bumpy to sit on. Once my mind is still, I can naturally feel the breath. How can I be with the beautiful breath? Just shut up and carry on. That's what happens. Once the mind is still, I can hardly feel the breath. How can I be with the beautiful breath? Okay, just carry on and be still with the hardly feeling the breath. There's something there where you're feeling. Just stay with that. Be still, and your mindfulness will increase. The power of the mindfulness will increase, and so you'll be able to see that subtle breath, and it'll become clearer and clearer and clearer. So you can hardly feel the breath, but the more you still, the more that subtle breath becomes easier to see and easier to see and easier to see as your mindfulness increases. And as the mindfulness increases, it's easier to see and it also becomes the beautiful breath. So it really is, just carry on, you're doing well, stay with that subtle breath, but be still, allow more energy to flow into knowing, don't waste it in doing things. Tanajan, could you please explain, comment on, talk about clear comprehension, its factors, functions and developing conditions. Thank you. My goodness. Clear comprehension. They usually have the words sati, mindfulness and sampajanya, clear comprehension. But anyone who knows Pali, sampajanya means like with panya, with wisdom. Pajanati, panya, panya is the same word. So it really means mindfulness with wisdom. So clear comprehension is the wisdom aspect. So you're aware, you can see what's going on, but you also understand it. And in particular, the main sort of factors of the wisdom in meditation, knowing what you're doing and why you're doing it. And what is, now keeping that about the goal in mind, stillness. Once you have the goal in mind, it means, what are you doing now? Is it creating stillness or is it creating more agitation? So as you're meditating, the wisdom aspect, you're mindful, you're aware, you know what's going on, but is it really going to be conducive to the goal? So if you're meditating, this is what I mean about seeing how you're meditating, whether what you're doing or how you're doing it is going to create the stillness you want. So if you're meditating, you see expectation, you're mindful, and the wisdom part of it, the clear comprehension, I can see, yeah, I'm expecting as I'm watching the breath. And you realize, the wisdom aspect also realizes, this ain't going to work. This is creating problems for me. This is stopping the goal appearing. So with the wisdom and the mindfulness, it means that the problem is solved. The other simile, the wisdom and the mindfulness, This is one of my cheeky stories against the Vipassana tradition. I shouldn't.